artists lose money, but they pay off in other ways. They invest in the studio's young talent, create experimentation, and most important, showcase the attention and excellence they channel into every task. In other words, these small efforts are powerful because they transmit, amplify, and celebrate the purpose of the whole group. Epilogue. Writing a book, like every journey, leaves a person changed. As I worked on this project over the past 4 years, I found myself noticing subtle moments of connection that I had previously missed. I appreciated how certain places, the local bakery, my children's school, the gas station, used small interactions to build a cohesive culture. I found myself admiring leaders who opened up about their shortcomings to create honest conversations. At home, I parented a little differently. I talked less and focused more on seeking ways to create belonging. Card games are the absolute best. It wasn't as if I were suddenly graced with X-ray vision. It was more like learning a sport. First you are clumsy, then after a while, you get better. One place I used these skills most was in coaching a team. It wasn't a sports team, but a team of writers at the Ruffing Montessori Middle School in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, which my two youngest daughters attended. The writing team competed in Power of the Pen, a statewide competition. Students practice all year for a one-day tournament at which they are given three short prompts, keeping the secret, say, or buried treasure, to produce three stories, which judges then score and rank. It's a fun and inspiring event because it combines the creativity of writing with the scoreboard adrenaline of sports. It's also an event at which Ruffing had historically struggled. In the previous decade, I'd been coaching for 2 years, its students had occasionally advanced past the first round tournament, but rarely got much further. This result made sense. After all, Ruffing is tiny, consisting of only 40 students, competing against Goliath-sized schools from around the state. But it made me wonder if our team could do better. So in 2014, as an experiment, I decided to apply some ideas from the research for this book. Our first weekly practice session in October drew 9 students. Catherine, Carson, Ellie, Vala, Caroline, Natsumi, David, Nathan, and Zoe were an energetic group with a range of skill levels and motivations. Vala and Ellie were confident and experienced writers, while Carson and Caroline were more hesitant, just starting to stretch their creative muscles. I was hesitant too. In years past, I'd taken a traditional, i.e. authoritative approach, to coaching the team. I did a lot of speaking, gave lecture-like talks, then provided feedback on their practice stories. In teaching parlance, I was the sage on the stage, and it was a comfortable place to stand. This year, however, would be different. First, I changed the seating arrangement. In years past, we had sat in loose proximity at a scattering of small tables. Now I shoved 4 small tables together to form one table just big enough to fit the 10 of us, elbow to elbow. Then, rather than launching into a lecture about good writing, I asked the team, "What's your favorite book right now?" We went around the circle. Harry Potter made more than one appearance, as did Hunger Games. Then I asked why those books were so good.
"Because he's an orphan," Ellie said. "Pretty much every good story has orphans."
"Because there's an intense war happening," Nathan said. "All these people are dying, and it's brutal, and you don't want them to die."
"Because it's just really, really good," Carson said.
"Why?" I asked. Carson swallowed. He was a tall, slender kid, with large dark eyes and a formal manner. He chose his words carefully.
"Because the story makes you worry about them," he said.
"Yes," I said. I gave him a fist bump, and he smiled. I asked the team another question. "What do you not like about writing?"
Answers came fast. They didn't like coming up with ideas to write about. Sometimes stories came easily, but often they didn't, and they were left staring at a blank page, wondering what to write about.
"I just get stuck sometimes," Catherine said, speaking for the group. "I get partway, and then I can't think of anything."
I told the team I had something to share with them. I reached into my backpack and, with a shamelessly dramatic flourish, produced a stack of paper, early drafts of this book. They took the sheets eagerly. They knew I was a writer, and they were expecting to find examples of faultless prose. But as they read, they saw that the pages weren't perfect. To the contrary, they were riddled with handwritten edits, line-outs, and fixes scribbled in the margins. Entire pages had been crossed out. It didn't look like the work of a published writer. It looked like a school assignment that had earned a resounding F.
"This is yours?" Nathan asked.
"Yes," I said.
"Are there this many changes every time?" Vala asked.
"Every time," I said. I told them that nothing I ever wrote was perfect, that I often got stuck and struggled through the process of building a story. I told them I tended to make lots of mistakes, and that noticing and fixing those mistakes was where the writing improved. Then I gave the team a prompt. After they'd written for 15 minutes, I asked them to put their pens down and explained a simple rule. Everyone was encouraged to read their story aloud, and everyone was encouraged to give feedback. Some of the students were hesitant about reading their stories aloud, and they lacked the language to critique other stories. But slowly, as weeks passed, we got better. Caroline, who hadn't wanted to read her stories at first, started to share more openly, bringing us into the sci-fi worlds she liked to create. Natsumi, initially hesitant about offering criticism to her teammates, started weighing in with warm, pointed guidance. We adopted a "what worked well, even better if" format for the feedback sessions, first celebrating the story's positives, then offering ideas for improvement. Over time, the exchanges strengthened into habits. The group stopped behaving like a typical class and started behaving like the kindergartners in the spaghetti marshmallow challenge, working shoulder to shoulder, fixing problems, thinking as one. Meanwhile, I focused on supporting those interactions. When someone wrote a successful story or offered a particularly incisive comment, I didn't say a word, but rather gave a fist bump. Like Danny Meyer, I flooded the zone with catchphrases to guide them through the writing and fixing process. One was "power of the problem," which reminded them that most effective stories consist of characters struggling with huge problems. The bigger, the better. After all, Captain Ahab doesn't chase minnows. Another was "use your camera," which reminded them to control the point of view. Do you want to take the reader inside the character's mind, or to observe them from above? I told them over and over, every story should have vow, voice, obstacles, and wanting. The bigger the problem, the better the story. You guys are creative athletes. You have to help each other get better. For me, in some ways, this coaching style was more demanding. It required more reflection, thinking about ways to ignite discussion and to motivate. I also struggled with the challenge of not doing things, allowing conversations to occasionally ramble off topic instead of leaping in to seize control. In other ways, however, the new style was easier. Instead of focusing on conveying knowledge, which demanded lots of preparation and precision, I could serve as a guide, letting the group function, watching for moments where I could step in and, with a phrase or body language, create some awareness, or better, highlight a successful choice they had made. The district tournament took place on Valentine's Day. That morning, a blizzard descended on northeastern Ohio, delivering 5 inches of snow and 44-mile-per-hour winds. We drove to the host school through the storm, catching glimpses of cars and semis spun off the road, emergency services workers huddled by the roadside, in a roaring moonscape of white that that looked like the zombie apocalypse. "We should write a story about this storm," Zoe said, and the rest of the team started weaving narratives from the images they saw. When we arrived at the host school, we found a table near the window. Then the kids bumped fists and disappeared into classrooms to receive their prompts and write their stories. 2 hours later, they emerged, wide-eyed and wrung out. At 3 o'clock, after scoring and ranking all the pieces, the tournament organizers ushered us, along with several hundred other competitors, into the gym to announce the winners. Long story short, we did well. In the 7th grade division, Zoe finished 14th. In the 8th grade division, Nathan finished 12th, Vala 10th, Natsumi 4th, and Ellie 1st. By day's end, we were lifting the first place trophy for 8th grade. A few weeks later, the team performed similarly well in another district tournament, where Zoe won first place and best of round. 4 students qualified for states, the most in the school's history, and Ellie won an award for talented young writers. But for me, that was not the highlight. The highlight involved Carson, the quiet 8th grader who had never done much writing. While he did not advance past the district tournament, he kept showing up at Tuesday practice sessions. He wasn't so shy anymore about sharing his writing, and he was showing his creativity in other ways. That spring, to the surprise of teachers and parents, he would perform a terrific Atticus Finch in the school's production of To Kill a Mockingbird. On the team, Carson's specialty was writing comic stories about a legendary character named Johnny McTuff, a tall, handsome, titanically confident high schooler who was under the misimpression that he was the greatest football player in the world. Johnny McTuff's stories were wonderful, partly because Johnny's unshakable belief that he didn't need anyone, not a coach, not a team, not his parents, not even a helmet, led him into all kinds of funny predicaments. But mostly they were wonderful because of the way Carson and the team interacted. Each week, in a swaggering, macho voice, Carson would relate Johnny McTuff's latest adventure, and the team would laugh uproariously. We would laugh at the spectacle of this misguided hero who thought he could take on the world alone. Then, we would all start working together to make that story even better. This is Will Dameron. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Culture Code, The Secrets of Highly Successful Groups, by Daniel Coyle. This program was directed by Andrea Kaufman. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Daniel Coyle. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.